I know like Apple Music is offering that. So you don't
Oh,
have to
yeah.
have anything but a pair of headphones in order to listen to Atmos music. And it's even possible on some computers I know, like Apple MacBook Pros, if you just play through the speakers in the computer, it's astonishing. It gives it, it's got DSP built in that just basically it sounds like the mix is all around you. So that,
Wow.
and none of those things are possible with, the classic, surround formats, which is one of the reasons I think
Sure.
that Atmos is going to probably, catch on a lot more readily than those did.
Welcome to Audio Branding, the hidden gem of marketing. Sound plays a more important role in human behavior and our decision-making than you may realize. In this podcast, I'll help you understand the art and science of sound so you can better influence others in business and your life. I'm your host, Jody Krangle. Let's delve a little deeper. Here's the first part of my conversation with Jeff Bonoff. My next guest is a musician, audio engineer, and producer. He's been performing and recording with his musical partner and wife, Maya, for over 40 years. And over the last 25 years, he's produced more than 20 albums for various artists. His name is Jeff Bonoff, and our discussion about the power of sound and music, the changes in recording from analog to digital, along with his thoughts on the future of audio with the rise of Dolby Atmos, will make this a fascinating conversation for anyone working behind the glass. If you're an audio engineer or just interested in where audio tech is taking us, this discussion should be inspirational. As always, if you have questions for my guest, you're welcome to reach out through the links in the show notes. If you have questions for me, visit audiobrandingpodcast.com, where you'll find a lot of ways to get in touch. Plus, subscribing to the newsletter will let you know when the new podcasts are available and what the newest audio chats will be about. And if you're getting some value from listening, the best ways to show your support are to share this podcast with a friend and leave an honest review. Both those things really help, and I'd love to feature your review on future podcasts. You can leave one either in written or in voice format from the podcast's main page. I would so appreciate that. And now, here's my conversation with Jeff Bonoff.
Hey, Jeff. So great to have you here.
Hi, Jody. It's good to see you.
I have been looking forward to this by a lot.
Me too. Well, me too, with a little bit of nervousness, but
Oh, you'll be great. This is all stuff that's right in your wheelhouse, so I have no doubt you'll know just what to say. So no worries. But I hope you've been doing really well and you're getting ready for Thanksgiving. And
I've got some family already here and lots more coming and a lot of cooking to do.
Oh, yes, a lot of cooking.
And panic house cleaning.
Oh boy, yeah, I feel you on that one. I suck at it. I'm very lucky to have a husband who likes going crazy clean every once in a while. Works for me. So I always like to start these off by asking you if you have an early memory of how sound moved you.
Yeah, I've always, I mean, since I was a little kid, I've always really, really been affected by, especially by music. And I mean, I remember like one of my earliest memories, I had a little like, toy record player, a phonograph. And there was this kind of music education album that I had that I guess my parents gave me. I had actually a collection of like old albums from my uncle, like from, it's like 78 RPM. Stories like Lone Ranger and biblical stories and all kinds of weird stuff that, I somehow inherited. But I had this album called Tubby the Tuba, and it was like to teach you about the instruments in the orchestra. And it was about this tuba player who dreamed of having a solo. And so I used to listen to that, and I wasn't even thinking in terms of being a musician someday. And then I remember just hearing like guitar music when I was a kid. But what really got me was I remember when I was a teenager and my family lived in the Boston area for a while, and we had a finished basement in the house, and there was this one side of the basement was just a stereo and a bed. And I used to go down there and put on albums and lie on the bed and read the liner notes and just really, you know, trip out on the music. And I remember especially the album Thick as a Brick by Jethro Tull and Close to the Edge by Yes were a couple of albums where just the sonics of them just blew my mind. Just the, you know, the music was, you know, kind of more involved, more intricate than a typical rock album would be, although I was a big fan of rock music. But and I remember, and this was really even before I started playing guitar or playing music, but I remember just kind of lying there and wishing to myself, man, I wish I could create something like that. So I think that kind of was the start of you know, getting me on the path of recording and producing music and playing music and
yeah,
all that stuff.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, considering that's kind of what you're doing now.
Kind of.
Yeah, I would definitely say that. So when did you start performing yourself?
So kind of like around that time and soon after it, we had moved to the Boston area and I made friends with some guys that were, and a bunch of them played guitar. And my dad had this really crummy acoustic guitar. My mom had bought it for him as an anniversary present, I think like for their 10th anniversary or something. But it was, you know, she didn't know anything about guitars. I mean, this was just the most dreadful guitar you can imagine. You know, the strings were like, you know, an inch off the fingerboard. So it was just like you needed to have the, you know, the strength of Superman to make a chord. But, you know, but I started playing on that, you know, just because all my friends were playing. And I had always been interested in guitar music and music in general. So, you know, and I wasn't any good. I was terrible. But you know, I was stubborn and then I saved up some money and bought a better guitar and just kind of went from there. So yeah, it was just, I guess, peer pressure.
I get it. Yeah. And of course,
pushed me over the edge into actually starting to learn to play.
Yeah. And starting with a guitar like that, I would imagine you then didn't need to worry too much about other guitars.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was quite, you know, I had a friend who had this model of guitar that I decided I really wanted. I saved up some money and, you know, this was back when like department stores had like musical instrument sections. So, I mean, we went to there's a chain of stores in the Boston area. I think it was called Leechmere. And I used to go there and just sort of drool over this Yamaha FG110 guitar. So I saved up my money. It was like $57. And
Not bad.
Yeah, well, this was like 1973 or something.
Okay.
But yeah, and saved up my money and bought that. And it kind of, you know, so it was a decent little guitar and set me on my way.
Great. Yeah. So you played in bands for a while. I know. Is that how you met Maya?
Yeah, I mean, this was much later. So yeah, by now, my family had relocated to Northern California. We lived in a little town called Grass Valley in Nevada County, which is in the state of California. But and there's an annual county fair. And by this time, I was playing a lot of electric guitar. And I was in I helped found the first really kind of heavy metal band in Nevada County. And this would have been the band started, I think, around 1977 or so, I guess, 76, 77. And we played at the county fair. And Maya was in another group. And I kind of knew of them and I knew who she was and who they were. And my picture of them, I had seen them when I first moved to that area. They had been performing at the county fair. It was like, seemed to be where I met a lot of the people that ended up being important. And they were kind of at the time I was just a young teenager at the time. And I thought they were kind of like a hippie folk group sort of thing. They were playing, you know, acoustic instruments and a lot of vocal harmonies and wearing very flowing white, you know, muslin-y clothes and stuff. So that was my impression of them. And we played, you know, this band I was in called Moria, you know, because I was a big Lord of the Rings geek.
Of course.
So, you know, we were, you know, so, and we were doing a lot of cover songs. We were playing like Led Zeppelin, Deep Purple, Rush, stuff like that. And have to get that Canadian content in there, you know.
Of course.
And
I appreciate it.
I was thinking of you, even though I didn't know you yet. Anyway, you know, we played and the gig went really well. You know, we had always, you know, been playing around, but it was like there was a huge crowd there and people really went crazy. It was really fun. And after we were done with the gig, Maya and the other people in her band kind of came up to me and said, "Oh, we loved what you're doing," and everything, which really took me aback a little bit because my image of them was, you know, from a few years before, and they, you know, their tastes had changed too. So, the following year we played again and, saw Maya and her group again. And my band was on the verge of breaking up. A couple of the guys in the band were members of the Mormon Church and they were going to go on their missions, which is, you know, young men after high school, they go out and, you know, spend a, I think 18 months or something going, you know, door to door trying to spread the Mormon faith. So they were going to be leaving town.
So that's why it happens. Okay. Now I know why. So, okay. Yeah. I never knew that.
yeah.
Okay.
So anyhow, so two of them were leaving. And so I knew the band was breaking up and we got done playing again and again, Maya and the other members of the band, which was actually, they were down to just three people. So the other two people said, "Hey, we're playing tomorrow night. Why don't you come see us?" So I did. And they were a trio and Maya was playing conga drums and singing and playing some acoustic guitar. And there was a bass player who also played flute, great musician. And another woman who sang beautifully, played acoustic guitar just really wonderfully, and sort of kind of played electric guitar. And they were kind of trying to play rock music, but, you know, she didn't yet have the sort of vocabulary to do that. And so their music was really interesting. I liked their songs and the vocals were fantastic. So I went up to the front of the stage, you know, kind of like you do to, you know, talk to them afterwards. And Maya was there and she just sort of said, "Hey, you know, we're playing this benefit concert." There was like a benefit. I forget what it was a benefit for, but at a theater in Nevada City. You know, "Why don't you come play with us for this gig?" And I was thinking, well, you know, my band's breaking up. Sure. Why not? So, I kind of moved my gear to their house where they were rehearsing. And, I just sort of never went away.
Are you looking for ways to improve your company's or podcast's impact? You'd be surprised how powerful the use of an intentional audio branding strategy can be. Want to know more? I have a free downloadable PDF that gives you my 5 tips for implementing an intentional audio strategy at voiceoversandvocals.com/audio-branding-strategy. That location does ask to put you on a mailing list, just to send you updates on when the new podcasts come out. But if you really don't want to give your email out, I understand. Just contact me directly. My email is all over my website, and I'll make sure you get that PDF without needing to sign up anywhere. If you do sign up, though, you also get access to a resources section called The Studio, where I have videos, white papers and PDFs, discounts from my guests, and snippets of audio from my guests that no one else gets to hear. So maybe it's worth your while. Totally up to you. And of course, if you're looking for voiceovers, you can get in touch with me about that, too. Now, back to the podcast.
You stayed there.
I okay. just sort of, yeah, I just out, completely outstayed my welcome. And, you know, I still haven't been kicked out. So
I suspect that Maya is the sort that would tell you if you had outstayed your welcome. Yeah. So, yeah, I think you're good.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I walk on eggshells a little bit, but, you know.
Well, I don't know. I think all married couples have to work for it. That's kind of how it goes. I know.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, going on from there. So I understand also that you're doing producing and recording mm-hmm. other people's albums, not just your own. Well, mm-hmm. how did you start getting into recording in the first place? Because like that's kind of also a leap from playing guitar and playing in bands to recording yourself. I mean, that's a whole other skill, right?
Well, yeah. So I started out before I got into recording audio. I got really heavily into MIDI, and I hope that the listeners all know what that is. But it's basically a protocol, a software protocol that allows devices to talk to each other. And this would have been basically what happened is one of the many, Maya and I have been through many bands up to this point and a lot of people coming and going and so on. And we had had a band called Syntax that we got some money together. We had a guy that was managing us and we got money together and we went to Berkeley to Fantasy Studios, which is a really, well, it's gone now, but it was a really, really nice studio. I mean, a lot of very, you know, popular albums have been recorded there. So it was a real legit studio. And that was my first taste of like real recording.
Did the bug bite really quickly? Like when you were in there, was it like, oh, this is my home?
Well, I mean, yes and no. I mean, I didn't know enough to know entirely what was going on, but I was mm-hmm. really interested. I mean, I was always the guy in the band that like, you know, messed around with the sound system. I was usually the guy who bought the sound system so the band would have a sound system, you know, that sort of thing.
Someone needs to.
Yeah. So I was, you know, I was always, you know, probably usually the most technically minded person in any band I was in. And I was fascinated by it, but honestly, back then, you know, like that kind of recording equipment was out of reach financially, you know, by any, you know, realistic measures. So I didn't really think too much about, you know, like putting my own studio together at the time, but I really enjoyed it. Although it was very stressful. We had a limited amount of money and time. So, and we weren't super happy with the way it came out because we were so rushed, but you know, it was quite an experience though. But we had all, you know, kicked in a bunch of money, but Maya and I kicked in the vast majority of the money to finance this thing. And then within a few months of doing this and our managers starting to send packages out to try to get us signed, which is, I look back on it now and it's just adorable that we thought we were had any chance at all of being signed.
Oh,
we
weren't no.
really that good, you know, but you know, it's like, you,
try, you
know, we were,
right?
We were, you know, we had our dream. Mm-hmm. And anyway, a few months later, the band just sort of imploded, which was just like, ugh, you know, again, and especially after having spent all this money and, you know, I was, you know, out, aww. You know, we were young and poor and
that's
you know,
heartbreaking,
you know, and Maya and I invested you know, something like $5,000 of our own money into this. And it was just,
like, oh my goodness.
Gone. Yeah, it was, you know, so anyway, the upshot of it was I had been reading about MIDI, which is, you know, allowed the computers of the time, which were not nearly powerful enough. This would have been like 1985.
Okay.
Not nearly powerful enough to, you know, be able to record audio, which requires, you know, a significant amount of processing power.
I remember those days.
Yeah.
My first computer in 86. So I remember.
Right. Yeah. So Maya had bought a compact portable, and I'm putting air quotes around that because it was like a little suitcase and
okay.
had a keyboard that clipped onto the front of the monitor. You know, it was all kind of a self-contained thing with a curly cord that connected the keyboard.
Okay.
And, you know, she was getting into writing, which she still does. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so she had bought that for word processing. And I sort of, you know, at that point, after that band imploded, I bought a MIDI interface to put into the computer and kind of hijacked her computer. So we had to buy another computer for her. But, and so we started performing as a duo and our setup grew to be where I, you know, we had racks and racks of synthesizers and we even had a MIDI controlled light show.
Oh,
and
wow.
So I would program, you know, and so I was doing, quote, electronic music, but I wasn't really doing what you would think of as electronic music. I was trying to recreate the sound of our band, our ex-band.
Uh-huh. Okay.
in such a way that just the two of us could play. So I was trying to program like realistic sounding drum beats that sounded like, you know, not like an electronic drum kit, but like a real drummer, and, you know, and so on. And honestly, I mean, I saw a lot of other bands at the time kind of trying to do the same thing. And I have to say, we did a pretty good job of making it sound human. And, you know, so I did, and I got very much, you know, with all the synthesizers, I was able to do a lot more. It was where I started to really get into producing things, because I could, you know, I had all of these different sounds and whatnot, you know. And again, this is before like we have now, where you can just in a laptop, you can have all these built-in synthesizers. I mean, there was like external gear involved for every single sound that we were producing. All the computer was a glorified player piano roll, sending out impulses to, you know, MIDI data to all of these devices to trigger them. So it was pretty insane. We were, you know, we were writing all our own material, and, you know, we had so much equipment, it would take like three and a half hours to set it all up for a gig. And we'd do our 45 minute set for, you know, maybe a couple of dozen people, and then pack it all up and go home. It was, you know, we were nuts. So anyway, yeah.
Wow.
We kind of came to our senses later and started, you know, performing just with a couple of acoustic guitars, and that was a lot easier. And we found that actually, you know, people were just as entertained by that as by my, you know, big MIDI extravaganzas. So we kind of got away from doing that live after a while, because it was just so much work.
Well, I guess now it would be a lot easier to do something like that, obviously.
It would be.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would be.
So the difference between analog and digital then, I mean, you were doing analog, like all of that would have been pretty much analog, I guess, mostly.
Well, it was a combination. So, yeah. I mean, MIDI is a digital, you know, protocol, but some of the synths I was using, this was, you know, again, this would have been like from like 85 up to about 95. We were doing, we did this for about 10 years. Mm-hmm. And some of the synths were analog synths, you know, I won't rattle off model numbers. It won't mean anything to most of the listeners, but, and some were, you know, digital synths were kind of coming in, you know, the Yamaha DX7 being the kind of the first really, you know, affordable and super popular synth, digital synth. So I, you know, my collection of synthesizers at the time was a mixture of both.
I remember doing tapes, like recording onto tapes and then turning them over and recording them for like extra, you know, extra tracks, right? That was the, oh my goodness. It was a Yamaha piano, and I was working with someone else who was playing the piano and making all of these things, kind of like My Bloody Valentine and like that kind of sound, right? Because I had a very different voice from what he was producing, and then the mix was weird. But that was 88. Yeah. So we were doing that from like 88 until 90, I want to say. And I want to say SY-77. Why does that?
Yeah, that's
a Yamaha SY-77. Mm-hmm. Yeah, something like that. So that's what he was using. And we were recording our tracks, and I think you could get as many as four tracks. But every time you recorded a new track, it softened the track before it. So it was a really interesting effect.
If you're recording to tape, sure. Oh. Yeah, that's, you know,
analog.
That's how it had to be done back in the days. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and, you know, so at this point, even there, I was not really doing any audio recording. This was all just MIDI programming and, you know, producing music that way, you know. And then I had, you know, I would play guitar and Maya would sing. And then I got a job for a music software company in 1995 doing tech support. It was a company called eMagic, and Logic was the sequencing program that, and there was an audio component to that. So I had to learn about digital audio for my job. I knew MIDI quite well, but I had to get conversant with that. So at that point, and computers were getting to the point where it was just sort of on the cusp of where you still needed like a card, in the computer with DSP on it to record audio, but it was just like within a year or so of my starting to work there, then there started to be native digital audio on computers. You know, again, very limited number of tracks and a limited amount of, you know, the plugins, you know, DSP effects were not that great at the time, but that's where I really got started, you know, putting an actual proper audio recording studio together.
Thanks for taking the time to listen. Quick question. Do you know anyone else who could benefit from hearing more about how powerful sound can be? If so, would you mind sharing this podcast with them? It would mean so much to me. Now, I'll stop interrupting and let you get back to the show.
So you've seen a lot of things change from the very beginning of analog music making to what it is now, which, I mean, exponentially, I don't know if it's improved. I think that the editing capabilities and the operation has improved, maybe. But
yeah, I mean, right. I mean, and, you know, there's a huge amount of nostalgia for the way things used to be.
Yeah.
And I mean, you can see the equipment behind me. You know, yeah. I have a certain, you know, share in that a little bit, but I also realize that there are things you can do today that, you know, maybe you could have done back then, but the amount of effort and expense to do it was crazy. And now it's, you know, it's really available to everybody, which is great. Of course, you still have to learn how to do things properly, and I hope someday I get there, but, you know, it's,
I'd say you're on your way.
Well, you know, it's, there's, you know,
there's always more to
learn. Yeah, there's always, and, you know, my great fear in life is to be the poster child for, Dunning-Kruger syndrome. I don't know if you've ever heard of that, but it's basically that people who don't know what they're doing don't know enough to know that they don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
So I try to always be aware of the danger of that and, you know, try to, you know, approach everything from the point of view of I'm still learning and there's a lot I don't know. So.
Sure. That's healthy.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that. Yeah. Where do you think things are going? I mean, there's Dolby Atmos out there now, and you've been experimenting with that, I know. So
yeah. Yeah, Atmos is really exciting. I have not set my studio up yet to, you know, really properly work. Technically you can do it in headphones. But I think to really do it properly you need to have, you know, a full setup of, you know, surround and elevation speakers and whatnot. And right now I'm very much, my studio is set up for stereo.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, one of the pieces of, you know, bits of friction for me, besides just the expense of all, you know, and the logistics of getting speakers in this room that would be adequate for doing it is also, the way it works, using outboard gear like this, you know, in the signal path as you're going. I mean, you know, for recording through, no problem, but I use this, a lot of this gear, sending out as I'm mixing and sending out buses or individual tracks to be processed by this gear. And that's really not practical in an Atmos setup, currently. I mean, there are ways you can do certain things, but so anyway, I'm going off on.
Oh, it's fine. That's what we're here for.
But that's kind of, yeah. So that's been a little bit of a, you know, one of the things that I've been kind of weighing, and just, you know, honestly, just the expense of, you know, all of the speakers that I would need and a monitor controller. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you really want to do, like, you know, serious work and be, Dolby has a certification process, so they come out, they send someone out to your studio, and they you know, tweak and tune things to make it, you know, and then they give you their sort of stamp of certification, which I think if I was going to get into, you know, offering Dolby Atmos services, I would want to do that. So just, you know, so it's something I'm thinking about, not yet sure whether I'm going to do it or just enjoy, Atmos music that other people produce. We'll see.
Well, it's true. There's not a whole lot of places to listen to it in its entirety right now.
Well, right? That's one of the cool things and one of the reasons that I think it's gaining traction where previous surround formats did not. And again, I mean, you know, I don't want to get too far off into the technical weeds here, but so, you know, like with a typical, you know, classic surround setup, like say, you know, 5.1 or 7.1, in order to listen to it, right, you have to have a studio that matches exactly whichever of those specs, you know, or whatever spec you're mixing to. But then the playback environment also has to have the exact same speaker setup, right? And so, you know, with Atmos, it's object based, and so when you set up a studio, you tell your software what the layout of your studio is, so it knows how to route things around as you pan them and do what you're doing. But then when you actually create your output file, which is called an ADM file, it just has metadata that has, you know, sort of the virtual positioning of everything. And then that file can then be rendered out for any number of different speaker layouts. So for example, one of the primary applications of Atmos is for theatrical use, right? So when you go into a movie, I don't know if you've noticed, like when you go into a typical movie theater, there are dozens of speakers, right? I went to the movies a couple weeks ago, and I counted while we were waiting for the film to start, and there were like 50 some speakers visible in the room, right? I mean, you know, just all along the side walls, above us, behind us. I'm sure there were a bunch of them behind the screen, you know, that I couldn't see. And so when the soundtrack for that film was mastered, they basically, I'm sure there are, you know, and I don't know exactly how theaters work, but I would imagine that there are standard speaker formats or layouts. And so the distribution company for that theater rendered from the ADM file an output file that knows where all the speakers in that theater are. And it just takes the metadata that says, oh, this sound should be coming from, you know, slightly behind your left shoulder, and sends it to the right speakers in that theater to do that. So it's very flexible in that way. The other thing that's possible with Atmos is that it can use binaural audio. So you can listen to an Atmos mix in headphones. So that opens it up to tons of people. So like, I know like Apple Music is offering that. So you don't have to have anything but a pair of headphones in order to listen to Atmos music. And it's even possible on some computers, I know like Apple MacBook Pros, if you just play through the speakers in the computer, it's astonishing. It gives it, it's got DSP built in that just basically, it sounds like the mix is all around you.
Wow.
So yeah, so that, and none of those things are possible with, you know, the classic, you know, surround formats, which is one of the reasons I think that Atmos is going to probably, you know, catch on a lot more readily than those did. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, we've kind of heard this before, right? there are a few things that have been predecessors to this that haven't really taken off. Unfortunately. So yeah, I'm encouraged by where Atmos is going, and I'm looking forward to seeing how it manifests itself with the regular everyday person who's just listening in headphones, because that's how you know it's been adopted, right? Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see where it goes.
Well, that's the end of this episode. Thanks for listening. And if you like what you heard, why not tell a friend about this podcast? It's available in all the usual locations. Until next time.